Our culture is a little bit different. We find with non-Indigenous cultures, women have been on the sidelines for a long period of time, and they're only just kind of understanding the value that women bring. Whereas women for Aboriginal culture are front and center. We only have to have a look at members of parliament. I think there's 12 First Nations members of parliament and 11 are women. So they're really front and center of our culture and what we do and how we move forward.
Welcome to The Greener Way. I'm your host, Rosemary Petrus, Senior Journalist at FS Sustainability. We are recording on Gadigal lands. We pay our respect to traditional custodians of country and elders past, present and emerging. I'm so thrilled to welcome to the show today, Mr. Phil Usher. Phil is a proud member of the Wiradjuri people, born and raised on Gomeroi country. He serves as CEO of Australia's only national Indigenous financial wellbeing provider, the First Nations Foundation. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Hey, thank you for having me. Excited to have a chat over the next 20 minutes.
What are the biggest misconceptions surrounding First Nations financial wellbeing?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I see happen quite often is whether it's banks, finance institutes or governments, they kind of get excited by the idea around financial well-being and education or financial literacy for First Nations people.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll take an approach that, you know, probably hasn't changed in 100 years in terms of money management and budgeting, and they'll roll that out into community.
Mm-hmm.
But what we find is there's a process that needs to happen before, and it's something that we do at the foundation. It's a bit of a healing process before we work with communities and tell them how to best manage or optimize their money.
Yeah.
So the conversation around, you know, just some of the historical policies and legislation where First Nations people couldn't earn money, weren't allowed to access it,
mm-hmm.
weren't allowed to have it, or if they did have it, they were told how they could spend it. So I think, and that stuff's really kind of recent history. So there's this whole process, like where we deliver our training, where we don't even talk about numbers or budgeting. We just kind of talk about some of the historical stuff and some of the challenges we've had as First Nations people around money.
Yeah.
And then we roll in to the financial literacy part. Because once we do the first part, the rest is pretty easy. So big misconception is that just need to get out in community and teach them finance and money and that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the easy bit. We've got to go through and kind of preface it and acknowledge some of those histories and challenges.
And when it comes to First Nations outcomes and financial empowerment, what keeps you up at night?
One of the things that's a struggle is we look at a group of people and we've been oppressed for so long.
Mm-hmm.
You've had so much hardship and so many challenges and difficulties
mm-hmm.
that now we're starting to see a period where we're kind of getting more money, whether that's through employment or you know, growing your career to more significant roles. Or even if we look over at some of the native title funds where members of that community are receiving royalties.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the challenges is, and you see this all the time when people win lottery, they go from $0 to $100 million, is you're trying to live for kind of previous years when you were oppressed. You're starting to have mm-hmm. a bit of fun. You're starting to buy more expensive things and you're kind of making up for time during that oppressed period.
Yeah.
So the part that I'm really concerned about, particularly with some of the native title stuff, is that we're not putting enough away, not even kind of that 10, 20% amount for a longer term period, because as soon as the mining companies and that close down in these areas, then that revenue stream is going to finish. So I think we're at a really exciting time where, you know, we've got money for the first time, but because we've been so oppressed, you tend to probably have a bit more fun with it in a lot of instances rather than mm-hmm. doing the sensible, smart investing thing.
So it's about kind of deconstructing and unpacking that relationship with money that has arisen because of these historical contexts. So when it comes to accessibility and engagement with the financial system, as you've just identified, it's a significant challenge for First Nations people, both in Australia and globally. What do you identify as kind of the biggest barriers here, and how can they be overcome?
Yeah, I think two big barriers lay within, one's in the superannuation sector, and the other mm-hmm. one's probably access to capital, particularly around that business framing. So the superannuation is a really hard sell for a lot of First Nations people. We just look at highest level concept of super, and you work until you're generally 60, 65, And then you can access your super. So you have to be 65 to be able to fully access it, or retired at 60.
Mm-hmm.
The life expectancy for Aboriginal male is 71. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of people in community that feel that they'll never actually get the opportunity to access their superannuation. So immediately, the way that's set up from a systems point of view is it's not really engaging for First Nations people, and it's not really fit for purpose. So we've got this interesting dynamic where it works for, I'm going to say maybe, does it work for majority of people? I know women have trouble in that as well once they leave the workforce, but it works reasonably well for, let's say, 80%, 90% of the population, but First Nations people, there's just not that appetite to engage with it. So it's looking at systems and structures within the financial sector and saying, how can we make this fit within First Nations people and some of our challenges? Now, the other part that I mentioned as well is around the business part, around that access to capital. Traditionally, capital is about, I'm going to invest in this business, or I'm going to provide a loan, and they're going to do, you know, how many sales, I'm going to get X return. But mm-hmm. what we're pushing for at the moment is looking more broadly at the impact First Nations businesses can have. They may not necessarily return the amount that you traditionally want from whether it's an angel investor or VC investment, but the impact could be far more profound. Mm-hmm. They might be having more social impact. They might be employing more First Nations people. And it's about framing what else they can do besides providing that 10x return. What can they contribute to the fabric of society as well as giving people a little bit of return or money?
And I'm particularly interested about the work your foundation is doing in regards to financial literacy within Indigenous communities. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we provide financial education, wellbeing training for Aboriginal communities right across Australia. And as I alluded to at the start, the thing that we do fundamentally different is we have that cultural conversation. So we talk about the historical challenges, but we also talk about what it is to be First Nations and earn money, have money and acquire it. There's a lot of pressures that come from community and family to share that resource.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about setting healthy boundaries for yourself, some non-negotiables and who you're willing to help within your community so you can look after yourself and your family. And then we just talk about our priorities. It's not necessarily that me approach as you'll see in traditional finance where you're asset acquisition, building your super, building your investment portfolio. It's kind of getting yourself to a level where you're sort of comfortable, but then looking what else can you do for your family or community with that wealth, and then maybe it comes back to yourself to expand your own assets. So these are the type of conversations that we have in our training and help people navigate that, help people feel a lot more confident and increase their self-worth. And then once we do that, we go into the financial education part that's really behavioral finance based. I tend to find there's two approaches. There's a mathematical approach, which is financially the best thing to do. You know, if everyone could save 40% of their income, we'd all do really well financially. But then there's that behavioral finance approach where what we're actually going to do is people with emotions. So we talk about more behavioral stuff in our training rather than just saying, cut out lattes and don't eat out. We look at ways that you can maybe cut down on your subscriptions, for example, to find cost savings and opportunities.
And as you mentioned, cultural conversations are so important. And when it comes to businesses and finance engaging with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, that kind of cultural competency is so vital. So how can finance and business professionals ensure that they safeguard that respect and effective engagement with First Nations peoples?
Yes, I'll do a cheeky plug for some of our training and education. We have a culture and money program. So there's a lot of really good cultural education, cultural awareness training that's available. But what we've created is something that's very specific for the financial sector market. So yes, it talks a little bit about the history of First Nations people. We go into how to best communicate and how to engage, but we talk about those historical things and why people are just not engaging with your products and services. Even though you might have done training, you've implemented things differently, we give them that historical and emotional context, which makes it a lot harder for First Nations people to engage. So we go into that, which in more detail, which we find helps these organizations just provide that context and just change their approach and their language a little bit more and help them engage much more with the the services that they're offering.
And your women's financial wellness strategy, could you talk a little bit about that? How can First Nations women be better supported in achieving that financial well-being and community?
Yeah, so our culture is a little bit different. We find with non-Indigenous cultures, women have been on the sidelines for a long period of time, and they're only just kind of understanding the value that women bring, whereas women for Aboriginal culture are front and centre. We only have to have a look at members of parliament. I think there's 12 First Nations members of parliament and 11 are women. So they're really front and centre of our culture and what we do and how we move forward. And along with that responsibility is a financial responsibility of the household or the community. So we provide these culturally safe and I guess gender safe arenas for Indigenous women to come together and have conversations about their lived experiences, some of the pressures around managing the money and just bouncing off each other with that lived experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also talk about, you know, what does a healthy money relationship look like? One with yourself, but one with also a partner. Because we find if you've grown up in a house where, you know, there may have been some financial abuse that's been experienced, which no one has a clue exists when you're going through it. It's only kind of professionals that can look from the outside in and identify financial abuse. But when you grow up in it and you see it all the time, then you think that that's kind of normal. So it's about having those conversations early on. And it's not talking about financial abuse, early intervention or pre-intervention training, because as I said, people just don't think that they're going through it. Rather, we talk about setting healthy relationships with your money and talking about things like getting credit checks and having a look at, you know, how you stand compared to a creditor and just having those culturally safe conversations. Given that it's a women's project, I probably can't go into too much more detail because I don't particularly know. Haven't sat in one before, but that's the framework that we sort of operate on.
It's a closed session just for the women, correct?
Correct, yeah. All women's business. So I have a framework, but our manager of women's economic empowerment manages the insights of that.
And I think we have time for one more question. Tell us about the partnerships, both corporate and public, that your foundation has forged, as well as I'm really interested in if you have any collaborations with other Indigenous groups overseas or other Indigenous organisations overseas that are working on similar topics.
Yeah, so we've really focused last couple of years. There's probably less formal partnerships or relationships when we look overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably more for different learnings. We find New Zealand and Canada are generally more advanced than what we are in a number of different areas.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a look overseas to find inspiration or models that kind of exist. And we find with the Maori people in New Zealand, their native title or their treaty equivalent is really interesting. We were there last year and went for a tour around Auckland, and they're showing us the $800 million of assets in commercial real estate that they own in that area. Which is vastly different to what we have here in Australia. And even the model over in Canada, where they have, you know, some phenomenal commercial infrastructure that then generates this long-term return back to people. And they've got a seven-generation principle. Like their investment mantra is, what can we do now to make sure we're looking after the next seven generations? So I think there's a lot of those fundamentals and principles that we can take from overseas and bring them into an Australian landscape.
Amazing. Well, Phil, thank you so much for your time today. It sounds like you're doing some really incredible work. Could you tell us where people can find you and connect with your work?
Yeah, so we've got the website, firstnationsfoundation.org.au, or we're pretty active on LinkedIn. Hit up myself, Phil Usher, can connect and chat on there, and First Nations Foundation on LinkedIn as well, showcasing the work that we do with other corporates and organisations, and probably a good spot to reach out if you want to have impact in this space.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Not a problem. Thank you.
I'm Rosemary Petrus, and that's a wrap for today. Tune in next week to hear all about investing in natural capital, sustainable land management, and carbon credits integrity with Sarah Clawson, Global Head of Investor Relations at New Forest.
The Greener Way podcast is a product of FS Sustainability, a show about people, the planet, and investing in our collective future. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. The Greener Way podcast gives listeners access to information and educational content provided by discussing numerous financial sustainable options and our featured guests. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of The Greener Way are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the FS Sustainability website, fssustainability.com.au.